of Witwatersrand and is a member of the board. Judge Goldstone has participated in numerous seminars in the U.S. on human rights and legal ethics, and he is currently a fellow at the Center of International Affairs at Harvard University. As I said, today he will talk about the judiciary under the state of emergency. He has agreed to speak on the record unless he otherwise indicates during the question and answer period. Justice Goldstone.
Well, thank you, Pauline. It's a privilege for me to have been invited to address this group. I thought I'd speak to broaden the subject slightly, and that is to talk about the role of the courts in South Africa, not only currently in the state of emergency, but I think also to make passing reference to the future role of the courts, that the future role the courts can and hopefully will play in relation to a Bill of Rights, which is very much a current topic of debate in South Africa today. Before speaking about the role of the courts, perhaps I should describe for those of you who are not aware, and I presume that would be the majority, how the court system works and how judges are appointed. It's fundamentally important to understand that there is an independent judiciary at work in South Africa, a judiciary certainly independent of the executive and of the legislature. The structure of the South African legal system has been inherited from the United Kingdom, from Britain. We have a dual bar of attorneys and advocates, as we call them, solicitors and barristers in English terminology. And for simplicity, perhaps I'll keep to the English terminology. There are approximately 12,000 lawyers practicing in South Africa. Of them, 11,000 are solicitors. That is, they're the people who get the clients, who get the work, who prepare the work. And then when they have litigation, when they have appearances in the higher courts, what we call the Supreme Court of South Africa, they have to brief barristers who are the specialists, the litigation specialists, the opinion specialists. They do two things, the barristers, mainly speaking generally. Firstly, they give opinions, written opinions, oral opinions, and consultation. But primarily, they fight the cases before the superior courts on brief from a solicitor. Of the 12,000 lawyers, there are only approximately 1,000 barristers. Within the barrister's profession, there is again a distinction that they divide into two, called junior counsel and senior counsel. In England, the difference between junior counsel and Queen's counsel. In South Africa, we used to call the senior counsel Queen's counsel until South Africa left the British Commonwealth in 1961. And since then, Queen's Counsel, what were Queen's Counsel, are now called Senior Counsel, SC. To become a Senior Counsel, traditionally one has to have been in practice for at least 10 years. One has to build up a large practice, sufficiently large to impress the chairman of one's own bar, because without his approval, one cannot apply for Senior Counsel status. In my case, I practiced at the bar from 1963 until 1976 before applying for senior status. I had to approach the chairman of our bar council, of the Johannesburg Bar Council, because I practiced at the Johannesburg Bar. Having got his approval, I then had to seek the approval of the chief judge of the provincial Supreme Court, on which I now sit, and without his approval, too, no application for senior status proceeds. Having obtained the approval of those two people, the chairman of the Bar Council and the chief judge of the Provincial Supreme Court, the application is then a formality. It goes forward and the appointment is made nominally by the state president, but there's never been a case, and there never would be a case, of an application for senior counsel being refused once it has the approval of the profession of the chairman and of the chief judge. So that the office of senior counsel is a non-political appointment. Of the 1,000 barristers in practice in South Africa, approximately 100 are senior counsel. Now, the importance of this is that by tradition, the judges are appointed from the ranks of the senior counsel. So there's a small pool of approximately 100 lawyers who have been selected on merit by the profession, by the public, really, because one has to build up a successful practice as a barrister to become a senior counsel. The judges are chosen from that group. Chosen, it is true, by government. The state president appoints the judges from those 100 people. Because of the small size of the pool, however, it is difficult for the government to appoint, to ignore people who should be appointed. And non-political appointments are the order of the day. On occasion, there have been political appointments, but then still from the ranks of senior counsel. There's no legal requirement, I should stress, that judges be appointed from the ranks of senior counsel. From a strictly constitutional point of view, the government could appoint any lawyer in South Africa as a senior counsel. The tradition has been broken this century, as far as I'm aware, five times. Since the present government came into power in 1948, twice. Three times. It was twice before 1948 and three times in the last 41 years. On all three occasions, lawyers were appointed, but not from the practicing bar. They were in fact senior counsel, but in government service. The tradition is that senior counsel in government service don't qualify for appointment to the bench. So that if one was a prosecutor in the Supreme Court, a state employee, one does not qualify for appointment to the judiciary. It's only from the private practicing profession that the pool exists. For this reason, whatever criticisms there might be, and there's some valid criticisms, I believe, of the performance of the South African courts during the state of emergency, whatever those criticisms may be, they are not the result of any pressure placed on judges by government. I can say without hesitation and without a fear of contradiction that any question of formal or informal or direct or indirect interference with any South African judge is quite unheard of and would be resented, I think, from the most conservative judges. If conservative judgments have been made, because they're made by conservative judges, not because they've been influenced by the executive or by the legislature or any other official. Let me turn to the state of emergency. The emergency which has been with us, the present emergency, for almost 3 years, these are emergencies which run from year to year. The present emergency comes to an end on June the 12th, and the government will then have to decide whether to extend the emergency or let it run out, as it were. It would expire, it would terminate by a fraction of time, unless it's expressly renewed on the 12th of June. The emergency is declared by the state president within his discretion in terms of legislation that was passed by the parliament in 1953. Let me say too, and I need hardly stress before this audience, that the fundamental distinction between our legal system and that of a country like the United States is that we have no supreme constitution, we have a supreme parliament. What parliament says goes. And the courts have no testing right, the courts have no right to strike down legislation as being unlawful or invalid. There's nothing against which to test it. The courts are subordinate to the law. Judges take an oath of office to apply the law and the Constitution, and that requires all laws of Parliament to be followed and implemented. The state of emergency having been declared by the state president, he becomes entitled to, as it were, rule by decree. He can pass regulations which have the force of law. The regulations passed by the state president under the state of emergency take precedence over even laws of the parliament. So it becomes the supreme law. However, that's not the end of the story. Because South African courts, by tradition and by common law, have a right of review. We have the right to review public officials, the decisions of public officials and public bodies. The declaration of the state of emergency itself is legally subject to review by a court, because notwithstanding the wide powers given to the state president, his declaration of the state of emergency is in fact an administrative decision. It's not a legislative decision. If, to take an extreme example, a hypothetical case, if a state president were to declare a state of emergency when everything was peaceful and tranquil in the country, but it could be proved he had some ulterior political purpose, he didn't want to hand over power at an election, or didn't want to call an election, if there was some ulterior purpose, the courts could set aside that declaration of the state of emergency as an abuse of power, or as being ultra vires, as being beyond the power of the state president. For the same reason, the laws which are passed, the regulations which are made under the emergency regulations themselves, are too subject to the court's review jurisdiction. They are not the regulations of Parliament, even though in some ways they are more important in the order of precedence than laws of Parliament. But the courts have the power to review, and this is the reason the courts have reviewed from time to time, for example, the censorship regulations. On occasion, during this current state of emergency, the courts have set aside some of the censorship regulations as being too vague, as being so vague that nobody could understand, nobody would know whether they were transgressing them or not. The government has then gone back and rephrased and reframed the censorship laws to take into account the criticisms of the court and to block the gaps, as it were, that were found by the lawyers and upheld by the courts. What's important in that review power is, for example, the power of the courts to review detentions. Now, a number of detentions have been reviewed by the court, some successfully, some unsuccessfully. But the decision of a policeman is given the power under the emergency regulations to detain people under one of four grounds. One of the grounds is for the safety of the detainee himself, which obviously is something that very infrequently, if ever, occurs. The power to detain is more usually used by the police, by a policeman who has to form the opinion that the detention is necessary for public safety, the security of the state, or to bring a speedy end to the state of emergency. If in the subjective opinion of a policeman that is necessary, he may detain a person without warrant for a period of 30 days. If the police want to detain the person for longer than 30 days, they need a certificate from the Minister of Law and Order. The Minister of Law and Order can then give a certificate for the detention of a detainee for a period up to the length of the emergency, which in this present case would be up to June the 12th. When there's a new emergency declared each year, the detention orders have to be reviewed and new detention orders have to be made. Now, let me give you a practical example of a case which came before my court during the first year of the state of emergency. The police decided to do a general raid on the university residence in Johannesburg. It's a mixed residence. They're black and white students who live in the residence. Incidentally, approximately one-third of the students at the university are now non-white. 50% of those in dormitories are non-white. The police came to the dormitories in the middle of the night, I think it was 2 or 2:30 in the morning, and went from room to room, I presume looking for whatever they were looking for. And they came to the room of a Miss Radebe, a black student at the university, art student, and she happened to be sharing her room that night with her boyfriend, who happened to be an employee of an American television company. Now, in those days, South Africa was getting the real treatment from the American television, as you will all no doubt recall. And certainly in right-wing quarters in South Africa, the American television networks were not particularly popular. The police saw he was a television cameraman because he had his papers with him, and in particular his notebook of his assignments. And he was detained. Without reason given, the police detained him. His girlfriend fortunately sought legal advice first thing that morning, soon after sunrise, and she got a public interest law firm to bring an urgent application to court. It came before my court at 10 o'clock that morning, and the girlfriend was very, very open. She said there are only three things that could have led to his arrest. One, he was a television cameraman. Two, I had on my wall a Release Mandela calendar, which had a photograph of Nelson Mandela and a lot of emotive dates, politically emotive dates, such as the dates of the Sharpeville riots, the Sharpeville killings, the Soweto riots, the date of the launch of the South African Communist Party, dates that would have been calculated to certainly displease most South African policemen. The third reason, she said, was that she had in her possession a book of Karl Marx, and she said that might have excited the suspicion of the police. Now, having Karl Marx obviously was lawful, not obviously, perhaps, but in fact, was lawful. The calendar was in fact lawful. Strangely, coincidentally, 2 weeks before, I had given a decision stating that there was no offence committed by anybody publishing that calendar, and had ordered the police to return 3,000 copies of the calendar, which they had confiscated from the printer some 2 or 3 weeks before the date of this application. So I said, if the calendar was the reason that they got excited, that was a bad reason. There was nothing unlawful about the calendar on the wall. And I said that being a television cameraman can hardly be a grounds for detaining somebody. There might be political objection to what the cameras were showing, but that wasn't a ground that fell under the powers of detention. And without hesitation, in that case, I ordered the release of the detainee. He was released, notwithstanding the wide powers of the emergency regulations, and he was not re-detained. Now, other courts have done that. The courts have attained this jurisdiction over the emergency regulations, I might add, not without an attempt by government to oust the jurisdiction. The emergency regulations themselves provide that no court may make an order or do anything in terms of in relation to any act done or any omission under the regulations. Now, you might wonder how the courts, in the face of that, were able to get round that ouster provision. The government's intention, presumably, or the state president's intention, was to put a stop to any court interference. What the courts have said, and this it has been the approach also of our highest court of the appellate division, is that where, for example, a person is detained for valid reason, when I say valid reason, I don't mean objectively speaking, but I mean that there are facts which could have led a policeman reasonably to come to the conclusion it was necessary. The police get information that Mr. X is part of a gang that goes around firebombing policemen's homes. He doesn't have to prove it in court. He can believe it's necessary to detain that man for 30 days and, if necessary, to get a certificate from the Minister of Law and Order to extend that detention. In a case like that, the court couldn't interfere, because on that information, a policeman could come to the conclusion that it was necessary to detain the person. In the case which came before my court, which I've mentioned, there I came to the conclusion that no reasonable policeman could remotely have come to the conclusion that it was necessary to detain the cameraman for any of the purposes under the emergency. Therefore, we said, because the policeman was acting outside his powers under the emergency regulations, therefore he was not acting in terms of the regulations at all. He was acting outside the regulations, and therefore the ouster provision didn't apply. The ouster provision applies to things done regularly under the regulations, not irregularly, purportedly under the regulations. So the courts have retained that jurisdiction. The next important decision in favor of the individual of the appellate division, that is our highest court, what's the equivalent of the federal Supreme Court, was it has retained the jurisdiction of the court to get access to a detainee. The emergency regulations provide that no person without the consent of the minister or the commissioner of police, the chief policeman, may have access to a detainee. So normal family visits, visits by friends or family, can only take place on permit being issued by the police. The courts, to cut it cut a long story short, have held that that access provision doesn't apply to the courts. It applies to individuals, but that if a detainee complains of an assault, for example, in prison, and there's a dispute of fact, the court can order the detainee to be brought before the court to give evidence and to give his side of the story. The same is true in an application for the release of a detainee. You might ask how detainees get lawyers, seeing that they have no access. The answer is that without consent, they cannot get lawyers, notwithstanding a decision of the lower courts to the contrary. In a number of cases in the lower courts, in one of them I was associated, in the case of Mamoniat versus the Minister of Law and Order, we held that because there was no right to be heard prior to a detention, there was a right to be given reasons for detention. We held that the Minister of Justice was obliged to give to all detainees reasons for his detention. We said this is such a serious infraction of the common law right of freedom, freedom of the person, that if it was taken away, the police were obliged to give reasons. And we said once they have to give reasons, once they're given reasons, the detainee has the right to make representations to the minister for his release. In other words, to attack those reasons. We said that once he has the right to do that, to attack those reasons in representations, he must have a right of access to lawyers. Notwithstanding the no access provision, we said it didn't apply to lawyers because it was such a fundamental right of the person. That judgment was taken on appeal to the appellate division. Unhappily, the appellate division thought otherwise. In a judgment delivered by the previous Chief Justice Raabe, the court held in a majority decision, there was a minority judgment by Justice Hookster, the majority of four justices in the appellate division held that the emergency regulations were so widely framed, that the no access provision was so wide, that the decision to detain was so final that there was no room for representations. They said, therefore, the minister doesn't have to give reasons. He said the detainee can make representations, but he doesn't have to get reasons. If he doesn't have to get reasons, if he has no right to a hearing, he has no right to a lawyer. So that was completely blocked. That was a decision which, in the Omar case, which has become rather an infamous decision, especially amongst human rights groups, it was a decision which set back the human rights bar, the civil rights bar, tremendously. Because until then, detainees had a right to see lawyers. They didn't have to rely on the discretion of a policeman whether to grant access to a lawyer or not. In my view, that was an unfortunate decision, but there you are. The importance, and I'll leave dealing with the state of emergency at that point, the importance in my view is that the courts have retained jurisdiction. I believe the fact that detainees can come to the court and they are being given access to lawyers. In fact, the practice is to give access, even though it's not a right but a discretion. And all detainees, emergency detainees, receive fortnightly visits from family. And normally what happens, if a detainee wants to bring a court application, he will normally tell his family to brief a lawyer and to give them the facts and to make application for a visit to the detainee, which, as I've said, is almost invariably granted. The importance, however, is that the police know that the courts have retained jurisdiction. I believe this acts as an important prophylactic, serves an important prophylactic purpose. I believe that if the very fact that the police know that they can be challenged in an open court, in a public court, must act as a break on the use to which they put those powers. I think the fact that a detainee can be brought before the court is important not only in relation to detentions, but also in relation to the treatment which detainees have under detention. Briefly, before we turn to questions, I'd like to mention the question of the future role. Many of you will know that the South African Law Commission recently came out with a report, a lengthy report, on a Bill of Rights for South Africa. The Law Commission is a government-appointed think tank. It's a permanent commission that sits in South Africa and has since 1973. It's a permanent commission considering changes to the law. It's not a political body at all. It deals with the nuts and bolts of the criminal law and the commercial law, the law of procedure, and so forth. But in 1986, to the surprise of many and certainly to mine, the Minister of Justice, on behalf of the government, instructed the Law Commission to investigate group rights and human rights in South Africa and their protection by the courts. The commission appointed one of its members, a colleague of mine, Justice Olivier, to take over this study. The commission consists of, I'm not sure, about eight or nine commissioners. Three of them are judges, two of them are of our highest court, of the appellate division, and Justice Olivier, who is a judge of the Orange Free State Supreme Court. The report came out recently, firstly finding that there's no need for protection of group rights, that if individual rights are protected, as they are in this country, one doesn't need to protect group rights. If the individual is protected, his group rights are similarly protected. Secondly, they came out in favor, firmly in favor, of a Bill of Rights. They drafted a Bill of Rights for discussion. They've called for comment by the end of August of this year, after which a final report will be put out. The draft Bill of Rights covers the whole gamut of freedoms as they would be recognized in any Western democracy. The Bill of Rights, the draft Bill of Rights, calls for universal suffrage, calls for one man, one vote, subject to an important proviso. The Commission felt that the political system was something that was not for the Bill of Rights, but was for the Constitution. So how the votes are to be exercised is a matter for negotiation by the government. The Commission speaks about five phases for the implementation of a Bill of Rights. The first phase, it says, is the acceptance by the Parliament, in principle, of a Bill of Rights. That's fundamental. The second phase, says the Commission, would be the repeal of all racially discriminatory legislation before a Bill of Rights comes into force. Because clearly, in terms of the Bill of Rights, no legislation which discriminates on grounds of race, color, or creed would pass muster. The Bill of Rights, incidentally, calls for judicial review, as it is known in this country, by the Supreme Court, by our ordinary courts, of legislation passed by government, with the right to strike down legislation that does not measure up to the Bill of Rights. Phase three would be an educational phase, educating the public and educating lawyers in the human rights field, which is perhaps too much a neglected subject in the Republic of South Africa. Phase four would be a negotiation with all the people of South Africa, black and white, on the terms of the Bill of Rights. The Commission stressed that if this isn't done, no Bill of Rights is going to get public support from the majority of South Africans. And phase five would be the adoption of the Bill of Rights in a referendum of all the people. The last two provisos, the last two phases, I think, indicate the seriousness of the Commission in wanting the Bill of Rights to have the support and the legitimacy from all the people of South Africa. My own view is that if there's going to be a more rather than a less peaceful solution in South Africa, I think the law has to play a fundamental role. I think that without a Bill of Rights, without curtailing power of government, I don't believe that this can happen. I think that there is a tradition in South Africa of independent courts, of independent judges. I think the courts have to be, the system has to be opened up. Thus far, we've only on the Superior Court, on which I sit, there's only been one woman appointed in the history of South Africa, and save for an acting period of 3 months, no non-whites have been appointed to the judiciary. So I think in order for the judiciary to gain legitimacy, I think it has to be opened up. I think new systems have to be looked at, because the present system of senior counsel is a severely limiting one. Only two non-whites in the history of the South African bar have attained the status of senior counsel. Both of them have qualified for appointment to the bench. One of them was appointed for a period of 3 months, but his black colleagues came down on him like a ton of bricks and said that he had no right to accept an appointment on the South African judiciary. So we had a situation where the people are polarized, but I think, as I say, that if there's to be any future which is more peaceful rather than less peaceful, it is to be in that direction. And there, too, the courts, I believe, must play a vitally important role.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Vince. Please identify yourself.
Current Department of Defense. Given the fact that you deal with public issues that are highly emotional and politically charged, do you ever fear for your own personal safety?
Not at all. There's been no history of political violence, certainly affecting the judiciary. One South African judge was shot in an unsolved murder in 1962. But that was certainly, I think, by accepted generally, had no political overtones or undertones. I've certainly, the answer is no. I've never felt for any problem about personal safety.
What is the likelihood that the state of emergency will be renewed, and what will that mean if it is not? Mm-hmm.
Well, if we can go off the record, if I can just explain my own position with regard to the record, I don't believe that judges should talk about politically controversial matters. I think it would be true of a judge in this country. I certainly think it's true of judges in South Africa. And this is not a legal... I'm very happy to talk about legal topics on the record. But when it comes to political matters, I'd rather be off the record, and I think this is one of those questions. Having said that, I believe the government is really faced with a dilemma with regard to the state of emergency. I think it would dearly love to put an end to the state of emergency. I think from an economic point of view, from an international economic point of view, from staving off further sanctions point of view, I think the government would love to call off the state of emergency. The problem is June the 16th is a very emotive day. It's the anniversary of the Soweto riots. Various other emotive events in South Africa have taken place and are commemorated on June the 16th. If the emergency is called off on June the 12th, when the government has to have, by which date the government has to have made up its mind, it's going to go into June the 16th, 1989, without the powers of stopping meetings, of curtailing political activity. I think the other dilemma that the government has is in relation to the release of Nelson Mandela. Again, I think the government would like to be able to release him. I'm not sure that it can do both, release him and call off the state of emergency. So I think these are the problems. And going into an election, I think the government feels very fears. It's fears from its right wing more than its left wing in this election. And I think it would be running a risk if it called off the state of emergency and this were to give rise to further violence and unrest in the country. I think this would be it would be seen by the government not unnaturally to be a downside when it comes to the election. So I'm not particularly hopeful.
Carl, please identify yourself.
Carl Beck, the Carnegie Endowment. There have been some interesting developments in the courts in South Africa in recent months. The appointment of Justice Corbett. I'd be very grateful if you could comment on how you think the legal what sort of direction he'll set. And then the Delmas II decision, which seems, at least from the judge's opinion, to recognize a special status for guerrillas in the Kotwe season. And then finally, the Maikisa decision, which seems to admonish the state not to bring frivolous charges of treason. Could you give us an idea of where you see the behavior of this conflict?
Again, I'd like to remain off the record. Again, I don't think judges should could talk about colleagues' judgments on the record. Firstly, Judge Corbett's appointment. Judge Corbett is one of the more liberal South African judges. I don't think too much importance must be placed in the choice of a Chief Justice because, as in this country, the Chief Justice is a primus inter pares. He's the leader of the team, but he's only got one vote. His power, however, in South Africa, unlike the power of the Chief Justice in this country to a greater extent, is the power to choose the panels. We have 14 justices on our appellate division. They sit in panels of five or three, depending on the importance of the case. The Chief Justice decides whether it's to be a five-judge panel or a three-judge panel. So, but certainly all emergency cases, for example, have been heard by five-judge panels. The Chief Justice chooses the panels, and there's some justices who are more liberal or more conservative than others. So the power to choose the panel of the court can be important. And I believe that under Justice Corbett, Chief Justice Corbett, the new Chief Justice, I think you'll get more varied panel sitting. I think the previous Justice, Chief Justice Rabie, tended to use a panel which happened to be a conservative panel to hear most of the politically important cases. Justice Hoekstra's minority dissenting judgment in Omar was a good example of a judge who didn't normally sit in that panel who dissented. I think there might have been other judges in the appellate division who would have gone with Justice Hookster in the Omar case had they been given the opportunity. But he is a leader, and I think he will lead the court, and I think there'll be really a breath of fresh air going through that court with Justice Corbett sitting in the Chief Justice's chair. Dealing with the Delmos trial and the Meyer-Kiso trial, the Delmos judgment I've read briefly. It's 1,500 pages, if my memory serves me correctly.
The Delmos II judgment, the trial of the Port of Rellis.
Oh, this new one. Oh, I see, right. Well, here I can only speak from my information comes mainly via the New York Times, but having some background to the Meyer-Kiso trial, I can say something about that. The most recent Delmos trial that was where the judge dissented from his assessors. Well, our system in South Africa, South Africa had a jury trial, a provision for jury trial in criminal cases, until approximately 35 years ago. The jury was abolished. Its abolition was unanimously acclaimed by people of all political stripes. In those days, needless to say, the juries were all white. In politically or racially charged cases, justice was not frequently done. In rape cases, as you can imagine, black accused were more often than not convicted. Whites were acquitted by juries, and there was generally a lack of confidence in the criminal courts, which got from bad to worse as the political system became more polarized. The jury system was replaced with a system of assessors, a judge sitting in any case which carries a capital punishment, which means murder, rape, armed robbery, treason. The judge is obliged by our law to call to his assistance two assessors, who are two lawyers, usually two barristers, in the cities. However, we have what are called circuit courts, courts that go out and sit in small country areas where there's no bar, there are no barristers, no advocates. In those cases, any lawyers may be called to sit as assessors, whether they be practicing lawyers, retired magistrates, retired legal advisors for the government service. They qualify to sit as assessors with the judge. The assessor is really a professional jury because the assessors have an equal vote with the judge on questions of fact, so they can outvote the judge on all matters of fact. What happened in this Delmos trial, as I understand it, is that the four accused refused to plead. They questioned the jurisdiction of the court to try them. They said that the courts were illegitimate in South Africa, the whole system is illegitimate, and they therefore refused to plead. The judge entered a plea of not guilty, and the state case, and he put the state to the proof of its case against them. They were found guilty of having planted bombs, let off bombs. Some people were killed. Many people were injured. They were found guilty of murder. That's the first stage. Unanimously, the judge and the assessors found them guilty on a number of counts of murder, attempted murder, and various other charges. The next question was the question of extenuating circumstances. In South African law, a person found guilty of murder without extenuating circumstances is put to death. The death sentence is obligatory. The judge has no discretion if there are no extenuating circumstances. Now, an extenuating circumstance is very widely defined in our law. It's any fact or consideration which lessens the moral blameworthiness of the crime. So an example, if somebody commits murder in circumstances where he's mentally deranged, or he's emotionally charged, a husband who shoots his wife's lover, who plans the killing, not in the heat of the moment, but plans his death, would presumably be found to be guilty of murder with extenuating circumstances. It's a circumstance which lessens the moral blameworthiness of the crime. Now, in this Delmos trial, the court had to decide whether there were extenuating circumstances or not. And that is a question for the judge and assessors. It's a question of fact, not a question of law. What happened here was the judge decided that because of the political motivations of the accused, and what they have personally been through, that there were extenuating circumstances in this case. However, his two assessors, one was a retired magistrate, as I understand it, and the other was a retired government servant. He was outvoted. His two assessors found that there were no extenuating circumstances. He found that there were. He was overruled, therefore, by his assessors, and he was obliged by law to pass the death sentence on the two accused. I would imagine that their prospects of appeal are not bad. The judge, having come to the conclusion that there were extenuating circumstances, will obviously weigh very heavily with the appellate division in reviewing the death sentence. The Mayakiso trial, Mr. Mayakiso, who is a trade union leader in South Africa, was charged with other accused of treason. They were leaders in a township, in a black township outside Johannesburg called Alexandra Township. They set up in the 1950, in the 85 and 86, many local people's organizations were set up, as they were called. They were really civic associations, they called themselves. They attempted, because of the breakdown of law and order, they attempted to really substitute their own committees, street committees, for the normal processes. They set up their own courts, which they called people's courts. They set up their own police forces. And Mr. Mayakiso and his co-accused were involved in that sort of activity. The government charged this as treason. They saw this in the first Delmas trial, in the treason trial. The judge, Justice van Dijkhorst, came to the conclusion that similar activity was in fact treason, and the accused were given long sentences. In the Mayakiso trial, incidentally, Justice van Dijkhorst made a fundamental finding, as I understand it, which was found wanting in the Mayakiso trial. In the van Dijkhorst judgment in that Delmas trial, it's confusing, there have been two Delmas trials, as you can hear. In that treason trial, the judge found that the purpose of the group was to overthrow the government. And that made it treason. In the Mayakiso trial, the judge found that there was no treason proved, that there was no intention here to replace the government, to overthrow the government, but rather an intention to try and govern within the township itself and to ease the plight of the black people in that township. And he held that wasn't a crime. And Mayakiso, therefore, and his co-accused were all acquitted. I hope I've answered part of the question that you put, Carl.
Yes.
Danny Bradlow, American University. I have a question more about the legal profession than about the tradition. You said there were two black senior counsels in South Africa. Could you give us some information on the racial breakdown of the legal profession? Also, could you tell us something about the size of the human rights bar in South Africa? And then the third question I have related to that is whether there's a growing practice among the law profession inside South Africa to do pro bono work, mm-hmm. and if so, what kind of work they do.
Well, firstly, the racial breakdown, I'd rather not be quoted on the figures because I haven't got accurate figures. They're approximately, I would guess, 15 non-white barristers. There are about 400 to 500 non-white solicitors practicing at the South African bar. There's still only the two senior counsel. I only know of one African barrister who in the near future is likely to apply for senior counsel status, and he's practicing at the Pretoria Bar. Most of them, as you can hear, are solicitors or attorneys. Most of them are practicing in black firms. There are very few white firms that have black partners. There are a number of black firms today, a number of white firms now that have article clerks, and have professional assistants, paid employees, associates, but not as partners. As far as the human rights bar is concerned, I think it's important, and I stress this, and here I certainly say the main public interest law firm, with branches in all the major cities, was set up in consequence of grants from the Carnegie Foundation and the Ford Foundation some 11 years ago. They found Arthur Chaskelson, who was one of our leading barristers at the Johannesburg Bar, to become the first national director of the Legal Resources Center. And for the first time, really, in South African history, the courts were used by black people to attempt to establish rights. Until then, blacks knew the courts as accused, or as perhaps litigants in commercial cases, and those were few and far between. But for the first time, the Legal Resources Center started using the courts to establish rights for black people, where government officials were misinterpreting laws or applying laws unfairly or unharshly or unjustly. They were brought to court, and decisions were won which affected beneficially the lives of many hundreds of thousands of black South Africans. The Legal Resources Center's tremendous achievement, too, in my belief, is that it's put human rights law on a very firm foundation. It's made it acceptable, politically acceptable. It's not politically charged to become a human rights lawyer in South Africa. 15 or 20 years ago, to talk about human rights, and a man like Professor John Dugard was in that position, 15 years ago when he started preaching human rights, he needed courage, and he had courage, and he was a very courageous supporter of human rights. Today, he's been left behind, virtually. He complains to me too often that he feels he's become a conservative in the South African political spectrum, where he sort of led the charge on the left in the direction of human rights. He's now been overtaken in the rush of South African lawyers, academic and practicing lawyers, in that direction. I think it's important that the leading Afrikaans university, Stellenbosch, only less than a year ago, or just about a year ago now, set up its first chair of human rights law, the Harry Oppenheimer Chair of Human Rights Law. And one of my colleagues and a good friend, Laurie Ackerman, who was a judge on the court in which I sit, resigned from the bench to become the first professor of human rights law in that university. The attorneys in South Africa, the solicitors, are their association is doing what it can to make sure that black aspiring black lawyers become articled clerks in their firms. It's difficult. I don't want to exaggerate, but the human rights bar certainly has grown at a fairly rapid pace. There's a tremendous amount of work, and there aren't enough lawyers, and there's not enough encouragement, I think. But I stress the important role which I think was played by American lawyers. You see, the English tradition which we have went in the other direction. The United Kingdom, England, hasn't had a history of human rights lawyering. It wasn't necessary in their country until perhaps very recently. And the tradition, as I mentioned earlier in my main address, was English. And it took the United States civil rights experience, I believe, to show South African lawyers the way, and that certainly has been happening.
And then with Susanna Hoffman, Howard University and Amnesty International, I would like to ask, with the new individual restriction order and comparing to previous banning practices, do the restriction orders have legal recourse, or are they also administratively?
Right.
And the other question is, with regard to new movement in South Africa to abolish the death penalty, would you give me your opinion on where you think that movement is going and what are the problems?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, the first question was about?
Restriction orders.
Oh, yes. Right. Well, what's been happening is detainees have been released subject to restriction orders. These are restriction orders you're talking. What's happening, initially when people were detained, they were released. Either they were released or they weren't released. What's been happening in more recent times, and it happened very recently with a much publicized case of Mr. Zwelakhe Sisulu, the editor of a weekly newspaper in Johannesburg. He was released subject to conditions. The police said, you are now released, but you may not work for your newspaper. You have to report to a police station, I think it's twice a day. You cannot be out of the area where you live, say, between 6 in the morning and 6 in the evening. You can't meet with more than two people or whatever it is. Those sort of restrictions. The answer is yes, it is subject to judicial review. If it could be established that there's no reason that they're too... let's take an absurd case. Let's assume he was told to report six times a day to a police station. I think that would be an absurd... I'm not suggesting that reporting twice is reasonable. I'd rather not comment on it. But the court certainly would have jurisdiction to say this is an unreasonable restriction and shouldn't have been applied. It's strange that it hasn't been... None of them have been tested in the courts, as far as I know. I suppose the fear, and it's a very real fear, I'm really thinking aloud, the fear, I presume, would be that the police might be tempted to say, if you don't like our restrictions, you can go back to detention. And that's not a very pleasant choice. They can say, we still believe that you should be detained. But because of the restrictions we're imposing, we feel that this meets the situation. It's not an easy one, but the technical answer is yes, it is subject to attack in the courts. And also the danger isn't a very real one, because I would guess that an argument that would certainly appeal to me would be if the police believe that the man can be released, but impose restrictions that are too, that don't make sense, it can't be an answer to put him back in prison. And that just doesn't follow. Sorry, then there was a second...
About the possibility of abolition of the death penalty.
Oh, about the death penalty. Well, there isn't a strong movement in South Africa, I believe, amongst black or white South Africans to abolish the death penalty. I believe polls have shown, and generally from discussions I've had, I think the general public in South Africa, as with most countries, I think there are few countries in the world where on a referendum a death penalty wouldn't be retained. Certainly, I think that would be the position in this country. The movement, however, is in South Africa is I think pinning more hopes on a reform of the death penalty. For example, to make the death penalty for murder optional, as it is with other crimes, for treason, for rape, for armed robbery. There's no peremptory death sentence in South Africa. The judge has a discretion, which she has to exercise judicially. So there's hope that will be the position, too, with murder. The second reform which is being called for, which seems an eminently reasonable one to me, is that there should be an automatic right of appeal against a death penalty. At the moment, the leave of the court has to be obtained before there's an appeal on any appeals in South Africa, including the death penalty. But I think hope for an abolition, I think, is a vain hope.
Yes, I'm back.
I'm Walt Harrow's National Intelligence Officer for Africa. I have a quick follow-on to the question on the state of emergency, which is, what practical difference would it make if the state of emergency were lifted? One argument would be that the government already has, under normal circumstances, plenty of scope for all sorts of discretionary moves to keep black political activists.
Well, it does make a difference. I agree the government has in its arsenal of laws, fairly draconian laws, which would give it power to do all sorts of things even without the state of emergency. It can detain people under the Internal Security Act on various grounds. But even that detention law can only be implemented by a very senior police officer, has to be of the status of lieutenant, colonel, or higher, subject to review by the courts. The restrictions on meetings, on the press, all of these are in terms of the state of emergency regulations. So it does make a difference. I believe if it didn't, we wouldn't have the emergency. And the government, there's no plus for the government in having a state of emergency if it didn't need it. So it's marginal. I certainly accept that it's not a question of doing away with the state of emergency and having the rule of law flowering in its full colours, because the state of emergency is out of the way. But there is a marginal difference, which is an important difference.
Alison.
One aspect of the river still has difficulty reconciling the relative
So how can you reconcile it?
Reconciling the relative ease with which the government has implemented the state and the condition of the court as described as a court system that is independent of political pressure. I wonder if you could comment on that. Do you think in the public mind perhaps there's an actual checks and balances relationship between the two, or do you think that the court system might in fact come at from the risk of political pressure in the future?
In the public mind in South Africa, you're talking about the public attitude to the courts.
Well, there's a contradiction.
What it is a contradiction. It's a contradiction in terms of one's general experience of international affairs. But it's a quirk, and it's a fact. It simply is a fact of life. There's been a long tradition of independent courts. I think the government enjoys having independent judges who don't constitute a political threat.
Richard, I think maybe the question that you posed is, the contradiction between what you say are independent judges and powerless judges. In other words, even though the state of emergency comes in easily to an act of parliament, which I think you said judges have very little role in, that's the contradiction.
State of emergency didn't come in through an act of parliament. It came in, did it? Was there an act of parliament passed for the state
for
of
this,
emergency?
No.
No, it was not of an act of parliament.
It's still lawful.
Right.
It's still lawful. And that the role of judges in South Africa, as you pointed out, although has some sort of review of ultra virus kind of concept, are somewhat powerless, although independent. That's the contradiction.
Oh, yes, no, absolutely. I certainly... Insofar as the rule of law is curtailed, that's a curtailment of judicial power. But when I was talking about independence, I was talking about practical independence from interference, not independence in the implementation. I mean, any judges, I would presume in any country, there are restrictions on judicial power. Judges are subject to the law, whatever the law may be. There might be laws in this country which judges don't like. Take the death penalty in the states which have retained the death penalty. I'm not suggesting there's an analogy between the death penalty and the state of emergency, for example. But it's a fact that we have to live with. I mean, it's a difficult decision. It's an interesting question. I must say, this is a polite audience. I had much less polite audiences from the students. When I address students at Berkeley and at Harvard and Yale, the first question I was asked in most cases was, "What's a nice chap like you doing on the bench?" Well, the answer I give is I won't say complicated, but there are a few facets to it. I think that serves me right.
For raising it.
The first point is that as long as black organizations, black liberation organizations, members of the oppressed black communities use the courts, I don't believe that I would have a personal crisis of conscience. I think that as long as there are black lawyers and black litigants who need the protection and who seek the protection of the court, I believe that the better the judges are, the better the system will function and the better the situation is. Secondly, and perhaps as importantly, I think the courts can and should serve an educational purpose. I think if we to have a decent South Africa in the future, in a post-apartheid South Africa, I think the courts are going to have to play a fundamental role. And I would hate to see the baby thrown out with the bathwater. I would hate to see a decent court system simply thrown out when there is a history of independence in the judiciary. Thirdly, from a purely personal point of view, when I was in private practice as a lawyer, I had a commercial practice. I earned a lot of money. I never had a holiday. I never saw my family. I had no part to play in politics. I had few contacts with the black community. In the 9 years I've been on the bench, I'm earning far less money. I've got far more freedom as far as my time is concerned. I feel I'm playing a far more constructive role in building bridges between the black and the white community. So in my position as a member of the judiciary, I think I'm able to do far more constructive work in endeavouring, and so far as anybody can endeavour to do so, in bringing about reconciliation and a more decent society in South Africa.
I'd like to just pick up on the point that Alison had raised and ask you to comment as to whether or not you agree or disagree or have some reaction to two quotations which came from this article I mentioned to you earlier in Leadership magazine written by Dennis Davis. He said, "The judiciary has been reduced to political impotence, particularly as a result of the declaration of the state of emergency in 1985 and 1986 and subsequently." And he then went on to explain that there were two sets of laws now working in South Africa. One, the set of laws to which you've referred in the body of your talk here, the legal principles which protect individual liberties against arbitrary executive excess. But then he says, under the state of emergency, there's developed a parallel system in which laws are initiated through ministerial discretion. And his conclusion is, quote, "Today almost all civil liberties in South Africa are governed by this second system of law."
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with both of those comments?
Well, from a practical point of view, I would agree with it, because there were 30,000 people, it's been estimated, have been detained over almost 4 years of emergencies. Mm-hmm. At one stage, there were 10,000 people in detention at one time. It's cold comfort to tell 10,000 or 30,000 people that they could have come to court, when in fact of those 30,000, maybe 100 came to court.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all very well, they would say, for you to pontificate and say, well, we could have come to court. How do we get there? There aren't sufficient lawyers, remotely sufficient lawyers in South Africa to assist us.
But the conclusion one then draws from that, seems to me, is that the hopeful signs of the role of the judiciary, which you pointed to earlier, are implausible until the state of emergency is lifted, at least as a first step. Otherwise, you're acting under such constraints that your impact is negligible.
No, but I don't think one must underestimate, and I think too many lawyers have held up their hands in horror and have become impotent.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the courts have to be, it's more important, you know, in Chile, as I understand it, the human rights bar could do nothing at all but bring cases, and the only reason they brought cases was to get publicity. They had no hope of succeeding in bringing a case. Now, I don't believe that they should be criticized for having brought court applications for the ulterior purpose of getting publicity, of publicizing what a totalitarian regime was doing. Now, South Africa isn't that situation. Cases can be brought to obtain freedom, to get restrictions lifted. Now, surely those things should be done.
But only on an individual basis.
Oh, yes.
You're not challenging in any way.
Correct.
The lawfulness of the original
Correct.
Law.
Because the system, even without the state of emergency, one hasn't got that power. But I don't believe it's either logically correct or politically correct to say, well, because of these infractions on the rule of law, we're going to do nothing. I just don't understand. I don't understand that argument.
Okay. Steve? Well,
actually, Pauline anticipated something of my question. I'm sure you're only too aware that one of the criticisms is that the judiciary is really making injustice legal and can do little beyond that. You're arguing that there's more space for action. I'm curious, the sort of treason trial field is now a growth business in the legal community in South Africa. In some cases, it's criticized as many lawyers are criticized for making an awful lot of money on this. But my question is, what further steps do you think, or how would you assess the legal community in its ability to test the space that the court system permits? Secondly, I wonder if you could assess two organizations, the Black Lawyers Association and the National Association of Democratic Lawyers, on those grounds.
Well, firstly, I think I've indicated, I believe that the human rights bar should be encouraged to bring more and more and more cases before the courts. I think it serves a number of purposes. I think it's important that the authorities be put to the test. I think they should be made to explain and attempt to justify detentions. I think every case that's brought to court forces reasons to be given. If a detainee comes to court and says, my activities consisted of A, B, and C, and those are lawful activities, and the police have no right to detain me, That sort of case forces the police, on the other hand, to present a case and justify the detention. So I think it's another aspect of what I was talking about. As far as the organizations are concerned, the Black Lawyers Association is an association that operates mainly in the Transvaal and Orange Free State provinces. I think they have very few members in the Cape and Natal. It's an organization, as its name indicates, of black lawyers. It does, I believe, play a vitally important role. It has an education center at which it educates black lawyers in matters where they need particular assistance, which they don't get from the ordinary system. I've been involved from time to time in giving lectures to them on professional responsibility, for example. They get special lectures on the bookkeeping requirements of the profession. They look after the human rights of their members. Generally, and an important role they play is to see that aspiring black lawyers get scholarships at universities and get jobs when they come out of graduate law school. The other organization, known by the acronym NARDL, the National Association of Democratic Lawyers, is a much more radical group, mainly based in Natal province. I don't know much about it. I know it adopts a much more radical stance. It's very difficult. I'll tell you an interesting example of give you an idea. It doesn't really answer the question, but it leads on from it. I mentioned the assessor system. Very few black lawyers have sat as assessors in South Africa. And I recently, in July of last year, had a murder trial in the Northern Transvaal, which is like going to the deep south. It was in a little town called Zanine in the Northern Transvaal. I suppose it would be a small Mobile, Alabama, in American terms. The case involved a black accused who was accused of having shot and murdered a white police officer. It seemed to me it was a case where at least one of the assessors should be a black lawyer. And I asked Justice Maloto, his first name is Justice, a good name for the chairman of the education fund of the Black Lawyers Association. I asked Mr. Maloto whether he thought I'd get a black practitioner in the Zanine area to sit as an assessor. And he said, no, our policy is that our members shouldn't participate in the system by sitting as assessors. I said, are you telling me I shouldn't try? He said, no. He said, at least give them the opportunity of saying no. And he said that in all seriousness, and I think it was a fair enough approach, and I decided to accept his advice. Well, to my pleasant surprise, I got a yes. I found a very, very bright black woman practitioner in Pietersburg who immediately, I didn't want to embarrass her, so I got a mutual friend to ask her whether she'd be prepared to sit as an assessor in this trial, and she came back, yes. When I got to know her, she sat on the bench with me for 16 days during this trial. And I asked her why she sat as an assessor. I said, you're a member of the Black Lawyers Association. I understand their policy is that you shouldn't sit as an assessor. She said, no, I know that. She said, I'm very active in the United Democratic Front. My younger brother has been a detainee for 2.5 years. In fact, she said to me, you've been visiting him in the Pietersburg prison. And she said, nobody can point a finger at me and question my political, where I stand politically. And she said, I love law. She said, I enjoy practicing and I want the experience. She said, where else am I going to get the experience of seeing how a trial is conducted from up there? And she said, I decided to do it. So I think it's important. I think the institutional and the attitude of other black lawyers that I've spoken to since was that she did the right thing. I haven't heard her criticized, and I'm not suggesting that it may be that they say one thing to me and something else behind my back, but I don't think so. I think the institutional attitude is one thing. I think the individual attitude is another thing. At Wits University, I think the fact that students don't participate, black students won't participate in sports activities, is an institutional approach. I don't believe it's supported necessarily by all the individuals who will carry out that institutional policy.
Lennon, you had a question?
Lennon Walker, Carnegie Endowment. Since the establishment of a Bill of Rights in concert with judicial review would represent such a fundamental and revolutionary change in the system, why would you go off the record and speculate why the government asked the Law Commission to do it?
Well, I would imagine the government must realize, I mean, there are two very important, fundamentally important opposing forces in South Africa. There's white privilege and power on the one hand, and there's black legitimacy, black majority, a black majority which has not only international support, but I think most South Africans, most white South Africans recognize the illegitimacy of the South African political setup. In 1989, I believe one has to be particularly peculiar not to recognize the injustice of the system. And I think that neither side can win in an outright battle, I mean, certainly in the foreseeable future. On the long-term future, I don't believe that there are many South Africans who don't foresee somewhere along the road a fundamental change. And I think if this can be done by legal means, it's the obvious way to do it. I can only ascribe good, sound logic to the government wanting to do this, and I just hope it gathers momentum.
Time is running short. We'll have time for one more question. Larry?
I'm Larry Silverman, State Department. I guess, judges don't want, they do want to keep politics out of the judiciary, out of the courtroom as much as possible, but I know that's difficult in the best of circumstances, and probably impossible or nearly impossible in South Africa. What do you think there will be an impact of the perception of change surrounding B.W. Botha's departure? Do you think it will actually have an impact on judges' thinking and therefore on their rulings? And then, because they feel that things will be loosening up, rightly or wrongly. And a related question, what is the power of judicial precedent? Carol was talking about the Maya Kiso case and other things. And could there also be a power of political precedent? In other words, you've seen certain reforms, the government has started talking about certain reforms, or you know that something is coming, you think that something is coming. Will that have an impact on the system?
Mm-hmm. And this can be off the record, too.
Right, I think very much so. Sorry, I forgot the first part. I remember the...
Well, I was just saying, what impact will the departure, the perception surrounding the departure of the
state? Well, speaking personally, I think the importance of de Klerk taking over from Botha is a generation difference. I found when I went on the bench, I was almost 20 years younger than most of my colleagues. I was just 40 when I went on the bench, and most of my colleagues were in their 60s. And really, we had little in common. When I gave custody of two young children, I remember, to a father, most of my colleagues thought I'd taken leave of my senses. They wouldn't do it. Young children go to a mother, they don't go to a father. And that's a generation difference. And I think the same is true politically. I think the fact that de Klerk is 20 years younger than P.W. Botha makes a difference. I believe the reform process is an irreversible one. I think that the black empowerment, it's one of the difficulties, I think, that are presented by sanctions. I think black empowerment, and I don't want to get onto the sanctions debate, which is a complicated one. I think there's a lot to be said on both sides of the balance sheet. But certainly one of the negative consequences, I think the less power that is in black hands, the longer it's going to take for fundamental change to come about. And I hope that the reform process is going to be speeded up and not slowed down with de Klerk. The indications are mixed, and they're going to continue to be mixed, I think, until the September election. But one of the more heartening straws in the wind, it seems to me, is the fact that the government now, notwithstanding the impending election, is proceeding to undo the resegregation attempts of the Conservative Party. I thought they would probably wait until after the election to do that, but I think they're declaring that position right now, and I think that's an important consequence. I don't know.
Political precedent.
Whether there are political precedents, whether judges feel that there can be political feel influenced by political precedents as well.
Well, I don't believe, if I understand the question correctly, I don't believe that there can be any political pressure from the judiciary. I think what judges should do, and it's really, I should have mentioned this in answer to one of the earlier questions, I think it's very important that judges comment on the morality of law. I don't believe that any case under the emergency or any case under apartheid laws that come before the courts should pass a judge's scrutiny without comment. I think it's legitimate for a judge, as illegitimate as I believe it is for judges to comment in public as I am, if it was on the record, I think it's legitimate to comment on the record in court. The place for judges to talk out is in court. And if a case comes before a court where there's injustice, if a judge has to implement a law which he considers unfair or unjust on any grounds, I think he should speak out. And I think more judges are doing that, and I think more judges will do that. And I think that this whole Bill of Rights debate is loosening judicial tongues, as it were.
But doesn't that really contradict what you said earlier? I mean, if you're going to comment on the morality of the law, you are going to be influenced by your concept of what is just or unjust. And that, in turn, is affected by your operation in society and your generational change. Brown versus Board of Education in this country couldn't have been ruled upon 20 years before. I mean, the times change, and so in a sense, you are, as human beings, influenced by the political
absolutely.
Trends.
But I don't see the contradiction. I think the more one articulates these things, the better. I don't think, is that, in what way is that inconsistent?
Well, I think that maybe the point of the question was that while we accept what you were saying before about there shouldn't be any political influence in the judiciary or from the judiciary as such, that inevitably, as human beings, there is a political impact which...
Oh, of course. I'm not denying that. But judges are political human beings as much as anybody else, absolutely. But it's a point I think I made in opening that conservative opinions are the result of conservative judges, not because of interference.
Right. Well, thank you very much. This has been very useful. And thank you all for coming. I learned a lot. I learned a great deal.